Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 107, Because Jewish. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are continuing our exploration of folks who are doing some of the most interesting and innovative work on the scene today, building new approaches to meaningful, spiritual, deep Jewish connection, but not necessarily through the institutional forms that we're used to. The organizations that we're profiling in this part of the series are all in the founding cohort of Moshe House's Open Door Project. Today, our guest is Dan Ain, the founder and spiritual leader of an organization in Brooklyn called Because Jewish. He explains the origin of the name, that basically people are always saying you should be Jewish because of your grandparents, you should be Jewish because of the Holocaust, you should be Jewish because of your kids, but he says you should just be Jewish because Jewish. Dan Ain describes himself as a rabbi and a revivalist. We'll explore a little bit more about what that means. He was ordained by the conservative movement, the Jewish Theological Seminary, and before founding Because Jewish, he was the director of tradition and innovation at the 92nd Street Y. He's gotten a lot of attention for the high holiday services that he leads at the Brooklyn Bowl with Jeremiah Lockwood, who is both a cantorial singer and a leader of the band called the Sway Machinery. Exploring the Because Jewish website will give you a good sense of the wide variety of types of events that Dan has been putting together over the years. They include discussions and experiences with some of the most incredible Jewish musicians, performers, artists, thinkers that are out there. Dan is both highly intellectual and highly spiritual. It's wonderful to be able to talk to him today. I should note for the record that Dan and I grew up in around the same area of Long Island. We actually attended the same grade school. We were a few years apart, so we didn't know each other very well, but it's wonderful to reconnect here on the show. And Dan Ain, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, I think that you're our guest who I have known for the longest, although we didn't really know that we knew each other, but we went to the same grade school.
You know, at, you know, SSDS in Jericho. That's where I think we got most of our best life lessons. So
I'm sure. Well, we've both gone wrong, and it's really exciting to have this conversation. So let's get started with a brief sense of what Because Jewish is, just to sort of ground our conversation. And then I want to get back into prehistory and everything that sort of post-history and everything that comes in between.
Sure. I left the 92nd Street Y, where I was the director of tradition and innovation, 2.5 years ago, because I wanted a canvas where I could just, I couldn't ever play an instrument. I tried. I was not good at piano. I couldn't paint, but I needed some artistic expression. And for me, being a rabbi and painting with religious experiences is an artistic endeavor. We create experiences that are emotional, intellectual, mind-firing on all cylinders. We do that often through collaborations with artists who are in our area and who have their own religious journeys and their own religious experiences. One of our most successful programs is called the Friday Night Jam down at a rock club on a Friday evening. And we'll get a musician, a rock star, to come and sit with us. And we'll do Motzi and Kiddush, and I'll share a little bit of a Devar Torah, and we'll have a little meditation so that people can arrive in the Shabbat. And we'll talk to the last guest we had was Chris Robinson of the Black Crows. We did that at Garcia's, which is up at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester. Before that, we had Craig Finn of the Hold Steady, and Lisa Loeb, and Rubble Bucket, and Ryan Miller from Guster, and Matisyahu, and they sit down with us, and they share their music and their creativity and how their religious life flows through that. And in doing that, they deepen that spiritual experience that I think a lot of people feel when they go to concerts and when they hear great music. And then after having that conversation about both the music, their spirituality, and I, you know, very key to us is understanding the community that forms around music and the formation of like the Grateful Dead community or the Phish community or whatever that might be that forms around spiritual expression. How does that manifest itself both in a religious context vis-a-vis a Jewish happening or, you know, a rock show? And it's been fascinating to hear about the overlaps. And what we've found is that then the musician will share a little bit of their music. And because we've had that conversation and we have created hopefully a heightened experience for people, they hear the music differently. And that is then spirit-filled music. I was going to use the word worship even.
So, I mean, I'm tempted to ask you a question, which is essentially, could you help us understand what Because Jewish is Not? And also, I think maybe in answering that question is also getting a little more color on what the various types of things that you do are in addition to that example.
Well, we want to find God in this world. And the story that I tell is that when I started at the Jewish Theological Seminary, Rabbi Mor Shapiro of blessed memory was teaching Talmud in the basement of JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary. And he was a Holocaust survivor and made it to America and worked for 55 years as a rabbi in different contexts around the country. And at the end of his life, taught Talmud to rabbinical students. And one morning, I, you know, wasn't that interested in the page of Talmud we were reading. And I said to him, why did you do it? After what you saw in Europe, why live your life as a rabbi, as a Jew? And he said, Judaism rests on three things, God, Torah, and Israel. He said, I love Torah. I love the study of text. Just look around. He says, I love the people of Israel. I love going to simchas. I love going to shul. Two out of three ain't bad. And that for me was the Judaism that I grew up in the conservative movement and other places where if we, you know, really learned Torah really hard and we really worked on community in Israel, that would be enough. That would be enough. This God stuff was just not really relevant, not really real. And we were going to be content with two out of three and make that work. That didn't work for me. And what I wanted to do, and I can share a little bit about my experience, but ultimately I was an attorney. And after 9/11, I decided that I went to Rosh Hashanah, broke down and cried, had this really emotional moment. And I saw the same type of, I saw my peers and everybody who had just experienced 9/11 in New York going to churches and synagogues and looking for something. But what I found was the same Judaism from the 70s and the 80s, the two out of three ain't bad Judaism. And I thought, that's not going to cut it. This is a missed opportunity. We are trying to create experiences in which people can feel a sense of the divine, that we can come into the apprehension of what it means to live in a world in which there is a creator. And we do that in untraditional ways, in different settings, unexpected settings, and with music that often catches people off guard. So, for example, our most successful event every year is our event that we call Bol Hashanah. So Bol Hashanah is the morning of Rosh Hashanah. It's Rosh Hashanah morning services that we hold at Brooklyn Bowl, which is a very popular bowling alley concert venue in which, you know, lots of big acts play at. It's a good spot, and it's very much connected to the music community. The owner of the venue is the same person who owns Relics Magazine. His name is Pete Shapiro, and he believes in formation of community through the power of music. And so I want to tell you what makes it interesting is, one, people walk into a venue, which is a bowling alley. I should note that there's no bowling in progress, but they have this wonderful concert area. We had about 350 people there, and Jeremiah Lockwood is our music director. Now, Jeremiah Lockwood is the front man for a band called The Sway Machinery, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. He is currently getting a PhD at Stanford and studying great cantorial music, and he combines it with the music that he learned by apprenticing with the Delta Blues great Carolina Slim from the age of 13 in the subways and on the streets of New York. And so when people walk into Brooklyn Bowl and Rosh Hashanah morning, they hear, one, Jeremiah's amazing old school Chazanist sounding voice, and then they hear his dobro, his blues guitar music, the gospel blues influence that he infuses the prayers and the liturgy and the services with. And it's quite a lovely thing. And, you know, it is fun to dance around with the Torah while Jeremiah and the band play an extended jam around Brooklyn Bowl. It feels very fun and relevant.
Who are the people that are connecting with what you're offering? And, you know, what are they finding in what you're offering that they're not experiencing elsewhere in the Jewish world? And I guess on the flip side of that is, could you go in a little more deeply into when you say just Torah and Israel is not enough, two out of three ain't bad. You know, what is that third element, God? You know, how are you interpreting that for you know, because I think a lot of times we sort of assume that the reason why people aren't connecting to Judaism is because they have trouble with the God thing. And here you're saying, no, you're actually trying to introduce it in a much more powerful way. And I'd love to understand that more deeply.
The reason that I think the two out of three ain't bad is a problem is because certainly since and I don't have the studies at my hand, but certainly since the last quarter of the 20th century, the percentage of, you can go farther back than that, but the percentage of Jews who populate new religious movements, new age movements, who go to ashrams, who go to Burning Man, who are fish fans, who are involved in the Grateful Dead, who look for psychedelic experiences. All of those people are, percentage of Jews across the board in cults and places like that are disproportionately, or gross proportion of Jews who populate that is much higher because they don't consider their Jewish establishments or institutions that they are familiar with or the Jewish organized world writ large as a space wherein they are going to be able to tap into the holy. It just, that's not what it's about. The two out of three ain't bad, and they want the three. And so Jews, it's a Jewish impulse to want to experience the divine. And so what we're trying to do is create venues and spaces through the lens of Torah, through teaching Torah, through holidays, and through alternative expressions of what those holidays can be to cultivate a revival. By revival, yes, I can talk at great length about the American religious history, which I think is relevant today, and I think it's not looked at. But the great American religious art form is the open tent revival, which probably dates back to the first, second decade of the 19th century, which was a rebellion against a secular expression that was there, or a rebellion against a dogmatic fundamentalist approach to faith that wasn't working for the next generation. And we have had these ebbs and flows in American religious history between the generation that experiences a revival and then becomes very religious, and then they codify what flows out of that revival into the next generation, and then it becomes dogma, and then the subsequent generation rejects that and they want their own type of expression because they no longer feel that spiritual revival that was felt in the previous generations. And so they have to reorient and reimagine what the Torah means for them, not just what it meant for their parents or their grandparents.
So you've spoken about how the specific sort of structure of how you do these Friday night jams of people sharing of themselves verbally with what sounds like their stories and then sharing of themselves with music sort of elevates the music to a place that wouldn't be otherwise. And I think that's really important to think about. And I'm curious, as you look back at various Friday night jams or other kinds of experiences you've put together, what's the difference between one of these events that quote unquote works, whereby there really is some sort of elevated sense of what we might call divine, or at the very least, you know, elevation, versus I'm assuming you've had other kinds of events that they might be nice, but maybe don't quite reach that same place. What are you like gearing up for? What's that goal that you're looking for in these events?
It's often about spontaneity and honesty. I think one of the things that really hurts religious services is putting on of airs, hitting certain notes in a rote fashion, the rabbi believing that they're playing some sort of role as rabbi. You know, I tell prospective rabbinical students or rabbinical students, the second you think to yourself, what would a rabbi say in this circumstance, you're dead already. And the best religious experiences have been, I'll give you an example. Recently, we had a Friday night jam with a band called Rebel Bucket, who's great. And in fact, there's a relationship between, you know, the two main people in the band, and they were both there. They had broken up 4 years ago, but the band stayed together. They had put solo albums out about their breakup, and they performed those. They talked about their breakup and then performed those solo songs that they had written together, which was very powerful. But one of the things that I ask all of the guests at the Friday Night Jam is to share with everyone an experience of the divine that they have had in their life. Now, not everybody who has been to the jam is a theist. So we had Alex Toth from Rubble Bucket, who is not, you know, a traditional believer, said, well, he had an experience of taking a piss where he found that during the experience, his body levitated above his apartment building in Brooklyn, and he was connected to everybody in the borough who was also urinating at that time. And he felt a oneness and a solidarity. I said, I'm really happy you shared that, because I had wanted to actually share with them the Asher Yatzar prayer, which is the prayer that traditional Jews say upon leaving the bathroom to thank God that God has fashioned our body in a way that makes it work. And I said I didn't want to share an experience of going to the bathroom. I said it's much cooler if the rock star brings that up. And people connected to it.
So having described some of this, could we back up and get a sense of how you came to this place? I mean, I think it would be really interesting to understand your own personal journey, which you started to talk about, but I think it would be really interesting to sort of get into the whole sort of road that brought you here. And particularly, I'm interested in the idea that you talked about early on, the idea that for you, this kind of Jewish work is an art form. And I think it's interesting because I've often struggled in talking to more traditional kinds of artists to sort of draw the connection between the powerful connection that I think there is between the way that an artist thinks and what we need in Jewish life today. And so I'm hoping that maybe you can help us make some of those connections a little more powerfully, and then we could go and explore them even more deeply with the more traditional kinds of artists who are doing work in the Jewish world as well.
When I say artist, I'm talking about that ineffable thing that happens when we hear some great music or great poetry or a great piece of art that moves our soul. That, I believe, is holy. It's hard to do this because I don't paint in any of those mediums, but I think that there's an art form to the creation of Jewish ritual. And there's an art form. The great American religious art form is, how do we get people together who are disillusioned and dispirited with the previous generation's expression of what life is and what it means to pray to God and what it means for there to be a God, or to grow up in a generation where your parents were totally secular and told you there was no God and it was like Santa Claus. So there's a rebellion to that. And to create that rebellion is very hard. You have to understand the world in which you live. You have to be on the ground talking to people and understanding how new mediums and new technologies are impacting the way people are viewing the world. So the idea of a watchmaker God is relevant when watches were the key technology. Now everyone's talking about, the Talmud as what? The internet. Well, that was 20 years ago. The Talmud is the internet, right? You know, we use the metaphors from our society to explain the tradition in a way that feels right for the people who are trying to live their lives right now. I mean, people, you know, what people felt in 1760 in terms of dance or song or ritual, you know, is only going to be so moving to people. I like to say sometimes that, for a lot of people, not for everyone, but for a decent amount of people, when they going to a religious service can feel like going to a Civil War reenactment. People are wearing the right clothing. They have the right muskets. They're saying the exact correct words that they should be saying that were of that time, but there are no stakes involved. There's no risk in their heart. It's play acting. And I think a lot of people don't show up in religious places because it feels rote, it feels like play acting, or it feels like pandering. And I think me as a rabbi, I feel called in a way that I don't fully understand, where the best I can do is show up from one day to the next and try to express and create space for people who are living in New York City, of all places, inundated with technology and garbage and swimming and anxiety. I can carve out a space in their lives and remind them that there is God in this world and that they're connected to a great tradition that has meaning and value, that cares about how they treat other people and how they relate to their neighbors. Then holy experiences happen, but it's risky, it's daring, and it fails from time to time. And the Jewish world is risk averse. There's nothing that is more threatening to institution than inspiration. Inspiration is threatening to institution. By definition, it challenges the foundations of it. And so it is hard for rabbis like myself, and I know plenty of others, who want to get people to feel a sense of God at the services. But when you do, you might find out other stuff about yourself or about your community that you don't want to look at. And that's too risky. That's too risky for a whole host of places.
So you've given us an incredible window with what you just said about some of what is holding institutions back from taking these risks. And you're talking about specifically the risk of deeply inspiring people, because that can be scary and that can open up a lot of unknowns. And there's nothing scary. There's nothing that threatens that which has been more than that which is unknown, I think, because it can change what has been into something different, and then it becomes what will be. All that's to say, I'd love to hear more from you on that. What are some of those other risks that Jewish institutions are afraid to take that you are trying to take? And maybe beyond just institutions, what are some of the risks that individual Jews either are afraid to take or have been taught to be afraid to take?
With regards to institution, they want to know quantifiables. They want me to explain to them what happens when someone prays to God and how to put that into a spreadsheet. I just can't do that. I've been trying in like different ways and different language and how many numbers and, you know, what does it mean if someone prays to God? What can happen if someone prays to God? My answer is I believe in the miraculous. I believe when you can do teshuvah, when you can come clean with God about who you are and what you've been, when you can acknowledge that and change your ways, I think miracles are possible. And I don't know what the quantifiable output of that miracle is going to be. I just know that I feel compelled to put one foot in front of the next and walk on the path. A lot of people think of God as a prime mover who puts everything in motion. That's not my metaphor for God. Right? For me, it's more like a Star Wars tractor beam pulling me in. I can't really get away from the destiny. I've tried, you know, on a number of occasions, but keep getting pulled back to the pursuit of creating religious experiences that are vibrant and can get people to pray in a way that can have miraculous outcomes. I think one of the misunderstandings that the Jewish organized world is under is the belief that in order to reach the people who aren't coming, that they have to be secular. But I don't agree with that at all. In fact, I find that when I speak this way, which is all day, that people, whether or not they believe or agree or are atheists or agnostics, they want to know that what the person is saying is real in their heart. They might not agree with that person. They might want to use a different terms. And sometimes that will challenge the people there. And sometimes people don't want to have anything to do with my services at all, because that's where they're at in their life. And that's okay. I mean, that's cool.
So we've heard a lot about Because Jewish thus far and all the cool artist-driven, creativity-driven ideas that you're bringing to the table. But what about you? What caused you to go down this path and become a rabbi, and in particular to become the kind of rabbi that's thinking up creative ideas like what you're up to with Because Jewish?
We grew up in the Solomon Schechter Day School of Nassau County and the Dix Hills Jewish Center out in Suffolk County, Long Island, which was not a place that I felt really at home. I maybe I was a late bloomer. And then I went to Brandeis University. My older brother had been to Brandeis. That seemed like spent a lot of time at Camp Ramon in the Berkshires, I should add, 10 summers there. And very much, I like to say, the poster child for the conservative movement. Although, you know, that's funny to even say that. And then law school, became a lawyer, and was asleep on an air mattress Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, in my brother's apartment. I had, you know, passed the bar exam, but I had aspirations of moving out to Hollywood. I had optioned a screenplay out in Hollywood, and I was in between places, and my brother came back and said, "Watch this." And then that changed everyone's world. And the following week, I went to services, and I had a very sort of moving experience at services, just sort of, I mean, on 9/11, I really felt scared. I felt that I felt the urge to run and help downtown, but I had absolutely nothing to offer. I had a law degree. I didn't want to have nothing to offer. When I went to services at Rosh Hashanah the following week, I sort of realized all of that, and I found the services were very much the type of services that I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and my peers, you know, were going to shul and church and looking for meaning, and I thought it was a real missed opportunity. And I knew that I just felt a calling at that moment, that I needed to be in this field, and I needed to find ways to make God relevant and present for people in their lives.
Were the kind of things that you do now, those artist-connected types of experiences and everything, were those things that came from your loves and passions that you had before, or were they things that kind of were going on in various ways in those institutions that you went through and you started to really fall in love with them?
I think I began from my loves, and, you know, I love music, or I love film. I began to try to create events with people who I loved, who I looked up to. And then, especially with Because Jewish, I began to create spaces in all different neighborhoods around New York and in Brooklyn. And in doing that, I began to soak up the art and the inspiration that people are into. And I began learning from them instead of me going and trying to teach them. You know, I think the best tool a rabbi can utilize is their ear. And to learn to hear what people are finding fresh and relevant, and then learning to love it too. So I'll give you an example. It's a weird example, knowing what generation we're in, but we did an event for Purim last year at the Brooklyn Bowl with the Terrapin Family Band, who are Phil Lesh is the bassist for the Grateful Dead. His son is Graham Lesh, and Phil and Graham Lesh tour around playing Grateful Dead music. It's called the Terrapin Family Band. It's really great. band, and they were playing the Brooklyn Bowl Sunday night, and Purim was Sunday morning. And so they agreed, Phil's son and his band, to join us for a Purim celebration, in which I retold the story of Esther through the music of the Grateful Dead, using the music of the Grateful Dead to hit the beat points. But I didn't know too much about the Grateful Dead, so I went and met with Rabbi Noah Bickert, to talk to him a little bit about the Grateful Dead, and he said it's all about scarlet begonias. Esther's all about scarlet begonias. There's a line in the middle of the Grateful Dead song, which is, once in a while, you can get shown the light at the strangest of places if you look at it right. And that, as we know, there's no mention of God in the Book of Esther, that it is all about our perspective, our Gilman lens or myth with which we come to view that story as a manifestation of God's holiness. And so I then, in front of, 200, parents and children, some deadheads, some jam band fans at the Brooklyn Bowl with their groggers listening to the Terrapin Family Band, as I retell the story of Purim through that lens, is really powerful for people. But then what happened, which was unexpected, I guess it shouldn't have been unexpected, is that I started to listen to the Grateful Dead. And it seemed like a lot of the subsequent conversations with different artists and different musicians really connected to their music and their poetry and their liturgy. And so much so, I went to see Dead & Company, which is Bob Weir's band. John Mayer's in that band. I went to see them in New York a couple months ago. And I was with a friend of mine, and he's like, people just go to this place. Because everybody who comes to the Grateful Dead, they just come to do drugs. They just come. That's all. Everybody I know comes here just for that reason. And it's just an excuse to do all that. And I said to him, you're missing it. You're missing it entirely. I said, this is poetry. This is liturgy that these people have shared with their family for a lifetime. This is a high holiday experience. They're connecting with people, and they're connecting with a spirit higher than themselves. You can see it through one lens, or you can see it through another lens, or you can see it through both and try to understand it that way. That's what we've been trying to understand and tap into.
When I'm listening to you talk, like, I'm just profoundly hearing what I imagine, right, is the way that a great musician thinks about a concert, right? You know, the way that I imagine that Bruce Springsteen, I know that Bruce Springsteen thinks about a concert as a revival, and as, you know, and that he's focused every night on making sure that he's delivering the experience that these people will maybe never have again in their lives, and that he has a sacred responsibility. And without trying to be critical in a bad way, right? Like, I don't think that people are doing this intentionally. I don't think they're trained to do it. I don't think a lot of people's personality is it. But I don't imagine that the majority of rabbis and folks that are in, that are leading Jewish services are thinking about each and every service that way. I mean, it'd be exhausting to. That's what we demand and expect from Bruce Springsteen. You know, so I'd love for you to really, like, I'd love to really, like, sort of get in deeply to, like what needs to happen in the Jewish world more broadly to sort of, offer what people need.
Bruce is well protected, and Bruce is well compensated. So Bruce has a comfort level in his life where, I mean, can you imagine what Bruce's life would be if there was no filter between all of the communications that people would want to have with him? How quickly would Bruce burn out if he wasn't able to moderate, or he didn't have people protecting him from his fans? I think a big problem in our congregations, if we protect no safety system, no support system to protect our rabbis, to understand that the job that they're doing, not only, you got it. They don't get how exhausting it is to do all of that. People don't understand that. You do. But people don't understand how exhausting it is to go up and to try to get 100, 50, 10 people to pray to God and to open your soul and your heart to them. That is exhausting. That is tiring. And people don't know the effort and the strain that takes. And that is inevitable. How could they? They can't, but that's a part of it. But I wish sometimes there was a little bit more understanding that existed. So that's the first part. The second part is Bruce gets to perform in front of a different audience every night. And so his Broadway play or his shows, for the most part, are connected, are run according to, he doesn't have to reinvent the wheel, I guess what I'm saying, every single night. Like I know Fish, for example, played a baker's dozen worth of shows last year at Madison Square Garden. And the big deal was that they played for 13 shows and never repeated a song. And lots of other artists were like, that is impossible to do. To basically reinvent the night for 13 nights straight seems impossible. We're asking rabbis to do that every Shabbat, at the least. That is exhausting. And very challenging to produce compelling content that frequently. I mean, if you think of your best artist or your favorite painter or a musician that you love, you probably don't want to hear their weekly outtakes.
When I hear that, I mean, it sounds so, of course this is true. And it makes me, it's like the natural inclination is to say, and therefore we can't achieve it with, you know, Jewish life, Jewish organizations. But another way to think about it is like maybe Jewish, you know, practice is organized in a way that doesn't work for the, maybe we don't need and shouldn't have services every week, or maybe we shouldn't have synagogues built in such a way that it is an expectation that it's a small community that goes to the same thing weekly. Maybe we should have traveling rock stars.
There are people who work in hospice and who are hospital chaplains, and there are people who work in Jewish day schools and are educators who, you know, do amazing, creative, artistic, beautiful work that is also equally artistic and beautiful, that it doesn't, you know, they might not be rock stars, but so there's also that part. So I just don't want to say that every artistic expression is some sort of blowout rock star thing. So that's the first part of it. And sometimes those beautiful artistic teachers don't have their courses fit into the scheduled programs at the curriculum that they have to meet. And so that's a whole nother thing. How do we solve the problem? I think we have to be more comfortable. I don't know what we as a Jewish world have to do. I just know that Judaism has been very meaningful for lots of people for many, many years. And often it is because of individual personalities who have found a different approach that has captivated and moved people, and that perhaps could not have been achieved without those individual personalities. I mean, we can name their names and we can name their books. And often their expression is some passion that they had to work out for 30 years of their own lives and whatever struggle they had to do before being able to present it to the world. We don't do that with our spiritual leaders. We chew them up and we spit them out, and we inundate them with garbage bureaucratic work and politics that nobody is capable of dealing with, you know, at a first job or at a second job. And then we just blame them when things don't work. So, you know, we have a, you know, and then we're not inspired. So what I would love if there was some way that the Jewish organized world could understand that not every result is going to have, be quantifiable in the fashion that they need it to be quantifiable, that there are leaders and artistic expressions and religious thinkers whose presence in our conversation, in our community, and in our world are reverberative. You know, that goes right to the heart of what it means to be a human being right now, and what it means to be alive. Those are the questions that our religious leaders should be thinking about and focusing, instead of how are we going to set up the chairs? And are we going to use tablecloths? You get what I'm saying.
I'm thinking out loud as I ask this, but I guess I'd love to hear, you've given us a window into your personal story in a few ways, and what drives you deeply to connect to God through music. I guess in sort of a full circle kind of move, taking us back to just that Friday Night Jam piece where we sort of started, can you flesh out for us just one or two situations? I mean, I loved your urination example earlier that you did.
I hope you use that.
Oh, that's in. Hey, listeners, you're hearing this too. I'm wondering if you can just give us one or two other moments of just sheer because Jewish transcendence, like the best, and it can be something silly like that, but like just so that as folks are you know, moving from this podcast into whatever is next, they can hold that with them.
So I would say a spiritual moment for me often happens after the events, when people reflect to me the type of experiences that they had. So, for example, we did an event with Craig Finn of The Hold Steady, and after the conversation, he got up to play the songs, and that was the week of one of these awful weeks that happened this past summer when we're dealing with difficult situations in our world. And he said, you know, I didn't realize how much I needed this. I didn't realize how much I needed this. And often we, when an artist comes or when a guest comes to one of our events, they don't quite know what it is or what's going to happen. And then when they enter willingly into that space, there is a feeling like, wow, I didn't know that I needed this experience. And then another thing that I want to share with you is that when we had Matsis Yahu come after the event, a guy came up to me, and he's in a different band. And he came up to me, said, you know, I'm Catholic. I came here, you know, because I'm friends with so-and-so. And my mother has been trying for my whole life to get me to be Catholic and to pray. And I want you to know that in between the conversation and the music, I stepped outside and I called my mom and I told her I was doing something religious and it mattered to me. I just got, you know, a testimonial from someone who said that our Kol Nidre service was one of the more profound spiritual experiences I've had in my life.
So just before we go, is there anything that you want to leave our listeners with, any big or small, you know, closing thoughts that you've learned from your experience with Because Jewish that you think would be great for folks out there to be considering?
Yeah, make time for prayer. Make time for prayer in your life and make time for prayer with your loved ones, your friends and your family members.
Thank you so much, Danny, for joining us today.
All right. Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate the conversation.
And thanks, of course, also to all of you out there listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we want to close it out in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can always check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us with a financial gift on either a monthly basis or just a one-time gift, and you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.